I'm Michael Cross, host of the KOSU Daily Podcast. Every weekday, I bring you the biggest Oklahoma stories of the day with reporting and analysis from our team of journalists and partners. Get the news you need to start your day in less than 10 minutes. Find the KOSU Daily in your podcast feed and subscribe now.
This Week in Oklahoma Politics is sponsored by the Oklahoma State Medical Association, cornerstone of Oklahoma medicine with physician members who are committed to better health for all Oklahomans. Learn more at okmed.org.
For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and civil rights attorney Ryan Kiesel joining me over Zoom video conference. A new report from the state auditor takes aim at the Office of Management and Enterprise Services and then OMES Director Shelley Zumwalt. Auditor Cindy Byrd accused Oklahoma of becoming a no-bid state after finding up to $100 million in questionable costs. Attorney General Gittner Drummond is now starting an investigation and calling on a resignation from Zumwalt, who now heads the Tourism Department. Ryan, what do you think of this audit?
I mean, I think it's groundbreaking. I think that we're only beginning to see the fallout from this audit. You know, this is the first real thorough look that we have seen of the state's examination of the spending of federal funding during the early days of the pandemic and kind of, you know, continuing through the expenditure of over $1 billion of CARES Act funding. And we've talked a lot about this on the program, usually in connection with the fight over the education portion of that and the governor Ryan Walters' effort to shift blame of that over to this company called ClassWallet. But this is a thorough wallet of this is a thorough audit of all of that spending. As this begins to unfold, we're going to see, as the attorney general has already said, whenever he called for Shelley Zumwalt's resignation from the governor's cabinet, as you'll recall, Ms. Zumwalt is currently at Tourism within Governor Stitt's cabinet, but she was at the Office of Employment Securities Commission, or the Oklahoma Employment Security Commission, in the early days of the pandemic. And there are questions about conflicts of interest and whether or not she appropriately disclosed the fact that her husband was an officer at the software company that contracted with the state for millions of dollars over the course of years. Mm-hmm. And I think that we'll see a closer look into a lot of the management and what these expenditures actually looked at. You know, as I've said from the beginning, this was a time that was unprecedented in state history. We saw a lot of, there are going to be mistakes that are made there. And I think that everybody at the state government level and everybody at the federal government level knows that this was not going to be a perfect situation, but there's a difference between, you know, mistakes in the heat of or in the fog of war, and there are mistakes that, you know, even in the fog of war, are going to be inexcusable by the federal or state government officials that are continuing to look into this. So I think that this is a developing story and one that we'll probably be talking about on this program for some time to come.
Neva,
I think that's absolutely right, and there are several components to the story as it's unfolded early this week. But when we talk about the Attorney General and what he came out and said with regard to the instance of Secretary Zumwalt, his words were basically to the effect that he thought it was one of the most egregious findings. He used the words wholly inappropriate, potentially unlawful, and called for her resignation, as you say, Ryan. So this will be a story as it unfolds, because when she was the chief innovation officer at OMES, this was the first occurrence that's outlined where her husband's company was paid $7 million for software services. Then she went to the Oklahoma Employment Security Commission, and again, this same company paid $8 or $9 million, multiple contracts. And now, as the Secretary of Tourism, the company in question has contracts or has potentially have some ongoing business. So that'll all have to be unraveled. Much of it is detailed in this audit, which is exhaustive, as you say. I mean, we're not talking about one incident. We're talking about looking at an audit that says basically at least $30 million and potentially up to $100 million of questionable costs have been passed through OMES. Mm-hmm. And so I think it didn't take very long, I mean, less than a day, for Senate President Pro Tem Greg Treat, along with Roger Thompson, Senator Thompson, to join together and come out and basically say, look, this is serious. This is something that we've been paying attention to. You know, if we remember LOFT, the Legislative Office of Fiscal Transparency, it was created back in 2019. It was authored, a bill that was authored by Senator Treat. And at that time, I mean, it was said, and he reiterated it this week, that they allowed the governor to administer the all of those funds during the coronavirus aid and all of the money that came flowing down to the states during that time. But they also said, and Senator Treat has stated publicly, that he felt that the governor's office had handled it, in his words, an incompetent manner. And that's why, as we remember, the ARPA funds were run exclusively through legislative committee. I mean, they took control and decided they would be responsible for distributing, again, millions and millions and millions of dollars coming down from the federal government that flowed not only into the state, but to counties and municipalities. And so it's a tall order, even for the auditor to begin to delve into all of these contracts, all of these vendor contracts, talking about, as you said up front, the fact that she's now calling Oklahoma a state that's becoming a no-bid state, and outlining the instances where OMES basically afforded that to be a reality by changing the vendor contracts so that the competitive bidding was basically eliminated in many instances. And there were no written protocols even to ensure that many of these contracts were legal, at least according, again, to the audit and what's been outlined. Right. So I think, you know, when you take the takeaway from this is the legislature obviously is beginning to weigh in on top of all that's been said by the auditor and inspector's office in what do we do, A, to make sure that all of this is out front and addressed. And with respect to the attorney general, his office will certainly, I think it's clear, make a concerted effort to see, have laws been broken? Is something rise to the level that that it's prosecutable and move forward? And I think it's important to note that Shelley Zumwalt has been emphatic up front, saying that she's done nothing wrong. She does not plan to resign. So, as you say, Ryan, this is a story that will go on for months and longer, perhaps, as they address these issues, and then also address what do you do to avoid these issues from continuing to be a problem for the state of Oklahoma and taxpayer money not being appropriately handled or expended on behalf of the citizens of the state.
Governor Stitt has vetoed Senate Bill 1470, also known as the Oklahoma Survivors Justice Bill. It would have allowed judges to consider past domestic abuse evidence when sentencing survivors for fighting back or crimes committed during the abuse. The Senate overturned the veto on Wednesday, less than 24 hours after it was vetoed. Neva, do you think the House will also try to override this veto?
Well, it will be interesting to see. There's a lot of speculation that that might or might not happen. Some believe that it may not happen, that whether or not that is true. I think one of the things that you have to look at and wonder why it wouldn't be is the fact that the House author is Representative John Eccles, who is the majority floor leader, a member of leadership, someone who would have some muscle to kind of push that envelope. But there seems to be at least some speculation that the speaker is not, you know, has not given any indication that he's willing to see this come up for a vote and override the governor's veto. So when you look at this bill, it should have been a non-starter, you would think, because the House passed it 84-3 and the Senate passed it 45-0. I mean, there was no, there it moved through, sailed through, and I think that this this veto by the governor, which is the first of this session to be overridden in the Senate, for the Senate to take that action, kind of sets the stage for a looming bigger problem, because the governor, I think it was 10 or 11 bills he vetoed, a lot of them probably not anything very noteworthy except for the folks that, that were working hard to get it passed and become law, and now it's been derailed. But it also adds to the drama of, you know, who wins when it becomes this kind of a major standoff.
Right.
In this instance, you had the attorney or the District Attorneys Association strongly out there supporting the governor to veto it. And then you had these other groups who have been moving this through the process, with Senator Treat being the, as I say, the Senate author, Representative Echols, the House author. So this will have a little drama and intrigue to it. We'll see what happens. I think most anticipate it will simmer for a while, and whether the negotiations and kind of the back and forth with a bigger picture of multiple bills may be in play, we'll see whether this one can make it out and, in fact, get overridden in the House just as the Senate did this week.
Ryan.
Well, yet again, we see the District Attorneys Association show their true colors, because, you know, they claim to be an organization of prosecutors whose job is to go out and find justice for victims of crimes in the state of Oklahoma. And really what their political agenda has been for years and years and years has been about making their job of getting convictions and plea agreements easier. They want the scales of justice tipped in their favor. They want to walk into the courtroom with every edge that they can have against a criminal defendant so that they can extract pleas, so that they can avoid going to trial, so that they can get, so they can have the biggest possible sentence on the table, so that whenever they sit down with a criminal defense attorney or a public defender, they're able to have the greatest amount of leverage possible to get that defendant to take a plea that has the greatest sentence possible. That's what this is. Any insinuation that the District Attorneys Association is really out looking out on the best interest of victims is really flies in the face of this bill. Because what this bill does is it says that if someone is convicted of a crime and that individual, the defendant, the accused, is able to demonstrate that the bill's very clear about this, that it has to be a substantial contributing factor of what caused them to commit that crime was domestic abuse, or that they were victims of domestic abuse. You know, so maybe you've got a victim of domestic abuse who is trying to protect themselves, and maybe they go beyond what is normally allowed under self-defense, but nevertheless, they're trying to protect themselves. So they've exposed themselves to some criminal liability, but this would put the court in a position of taking that that fact that they are a victim of domestic violence. And the court has to find that by a preponderance of the evidence. This isn't just something where a defendant gets to say, I'm a victim of domestic violence, and the court has to buy that. No, the court has to find that by evidence, by a standard of preponderance of the evidence. So that's not an easy standard to meet. Mm-hmm. And it is bewildering that the governor vetoed this, because this isn't about, you know, the governor's veto message seemed to say that if that this would allow for someone to claim a very attenuated incident of domestic violence years and years in the past, would by one person could be used to justify a reduction in their sentence because they've committed a crime years and years later against another person. And the language of the bill is just clearly not that. It has to be, they have to demonstrate by a preponderance of the evidence that they were a victim. And then there has to be a showing by a preponderance of the evidence that that was a contributing factor to why they committed that crime in the first place. So this idea of, you know, these attenuated incidents being used by defendants to get out of crimes just doesn't really hold a lot of water. And as you said, Neva, this is President Pro Tem Treat. That's why you saw the Senate and passed by overwhelming vote to begin with. That's why you saw the veto there. The House author of this is Representative John Eccles. He's the floor leader. He's one of the most powerful members of the legislature, one of the most powerful people in the building, the state capitol. And yeah, I think that if he brings this to the floor, that it will probably be overridden by the House as well. It's just a question of, you know, whether conversations between floor leader Eccles, Speaker McCaul, and the governor, and maybe even collateral items out there at the capitol, allow this to come to a vote on the floor to begin with. But I think if it comes up on the floor for an override vote, I think we'll see a similar vote that we saw over the Senate, and the governor's veto will be overridden.
Governor Stitt is getting a controversial Texas-style immigration bill passed the Senate earlier this week, despite protests at the state capitol. Governor Stitt has mentioned he's not sure whether he will sign it. Now, we are recording this on Thursday, the 25th, so this might change quickly. But Neva, what do you think of this bill?
Well, I mean, we've talked about it before as it was getting ready to come up, and the Senate passed it 39-8. They took a lengthy afternoon for debate. And I think what if anyone had listened or watched that debate, they would have seen both sides very eloquently laying out their position on this particular bill. I think it is interesting that the governor has said up front that he's uncertain what he's going to do with respect to signing or not signing the bill. But let's remember, this is a piece of legislation that the Attorney General, Governor Drummond, originally requested of the legislature. He basically took the position that what was needed was a law like this that would allow enforcement officers, law enforcement, to be able to really dig in and combat the numerous illegal marijuana grow operations. That was a lot of the focus of how this bill was kind of sought after and crafted. So much of the counter to that and the arguments against it, laying out that immigrant people were being used as pawns in a political game that some of the folks at the rally that day were trying to lay out there in a very concerted effort to try to hopefully sway the opinion of those members of the Senate. But it basically wound up being what I think most people expected in terms of not only the 39-8 vote, but the fact that this is a measure that many people believe you have to put tools in place to go after the criminal element and much of what's going on. And it does spill off from the fact that, as many in the legislature have said over and over again this session in particular, this comes as a time when the Biden administration has failed to secure the border, and it has become problematic for every state. In essence, basically every state becoming a border state in terms of what they're having to deal with in the aftermath. So we'll watch with interest what the governor does. Obviously, there are political ramifications, and certainly given much of what he said during his time in office, many would expect that he would sign the bill, but there, again, has been no indication that might be in the offing.
Yeah, Ryan.
Now, I think that there are a few things to think about when we think about this legislation. Yeah, first and foremost, this is a political issue. As we have mentioned on this program many times before, just about every public opinion poll that you look at that's both public, and if you looked at internal polling for candidates in the state of Oklahoma and really around the country, you're going to see that immigration is in the top three, if not the top issue on voters' minds. And even though this is a federal issue, and I'll get to that in a moment, you're going to have a lot of lawmakers going out and knocking doors this summer, primarily in primary campaigns are going to be out knocking doors, and voters are going to ask them about immigration. Voters aren't going to care whether this is a federal or a state issue, or at least a lot of voters aren't. They're going to want to know, what are you doing about this? Because that's what's on voters' minds. And these lawmakers need something to be able to say to these folks on the doorstep. They need something to put in a mail piece that says, I'm, you know, standing tough against illegal immigration, because that's what's on voters' minds. And that's what candidates need to do. They need to be able to talk about what voters are thinking about, regardless of whether they have any actual role in solving the problem or not. That brings me to the second point of solving the problem. This is a federal government problem. I mean, this has been something that has been going on for decades. There hasn't been any action, real clear action from Congress or the executive branch coming together for decades to solve the actual immigration crisis that we continue to see unfold under Democratic presidents and under Republican presidents, under Republican majorities and under Democratic majorities. It's something that continues to unfold and only seems to get worse every year. And we have a solution at this point. It's not a solution that fixes everything, but there is a real opportunity for reform that's led in large part by Oklahoma's own Senator James Lankford that passed the United States Senate, that if it were heard on the United States House of Representatives floor today, would probably pass. And President Biden has said that he would sign it. So we've got this potential for real bipartisan action here. But former President Donald Trump has instructed his minions in the United States House of Representatives to not put this up on the floor so that he can preserve it as a campaign issue for the fall election. He wants to be able to campaign that Joe Biden hasn't done anything. And then finally, if we look at how this plays out in reality, this could put enormous strain on county jails. And trust me, I understand the plight of county jails about as well as anyone in the state of Oklahoma because I'm suing some of them. Mm-hmm. And I understand how they are unable to perform their basic functions in many instances already. And putting more and more people eligible for detention in those county jails puts a strain on county government and sheriff's departments and jail trust that they simply cannot afford at this moment. So I think that that's something that if the governor is going to veto this, I think that the strain on local law enforcement might be the thing that would convince him to veto this. But as you said, his rhetoric in the past seems to indicate that this is the kind of legislation that he's going to sign and we're going to see on campaign mailers coming to a mailbox near you soon.
And you're right, Ryan. I mean, the political ramifications, one thing, but the reality of this piece of legislation, absent Congress doing something, which it does not appear will happen before the November elections, and we see what takes place in when the dust settles after that. Right now, this is an opportunity for the state of Oklahoma to potentially pass and sign legislation that would give law enforcement officers the authority to arrest people who are not legally in the state of Oklahoma. And in the instance of many of the things that have been talked about, may be involved in illegal activities. And certainly the pressure to continue to focus on the amount of illegal drugs coming into the state, as all states are experiencing, it's incumbent upon lawmakers to do what they can. In the absence of something done at the federal level, this is an opportunity to at least begin to address it. And obviously, one would expect that no single bill is going to address it fully, but it does open the door to a larger ongoing conversation with lawmakers, the attorney general, the governor, and others to see how to move the needle and actually get some productive results for the citizens in our state.
Oklahoma City Democratic Senator Kerry Hicks is refusing to carry a couple of executive nominations from Governor Stitt. Senator Hicks says she doesn't approve of Alex Gray for the State Board of Education and Audrey Cadogan for the Department of Libraries. Ryan, why is Hicks declining to carry the nominations, and will it have any impact in the Republican-dominated Senate?
I don't think that we've seen, I haven't seen the actual details of what Senator Hicks has said are the deficiencies in these nominations. But I think that one thing is clear. Senator Kerry Hicks is one of the leaders on education policy and understanding education policy in the state of Oklahoma. As a former classroom teacher before joining the United States Senate, we could be talking about that, at some point in her future, if the political winds in Oklahoma change quite a bit, but she would certainly be qualified. But Senator Hicks, before joining the Oklahoma State Senate, was a classroom teacher and understands the needs of teachers, educators, support staff, administrators, parents, students, as well or more than most at the state capitol. So when Senator Hicks says that she finds someone unqualified for these positions, I don't think that she says that lightly. I don't think that she would put out a release and hold up these nominations or refuse to carry these nominations simply because they came from a Republican governor or because these individuals may belong to a different political party than Senator Hicks. I think that Senator Hicks is the kind of person that is going to look at what's this individual's qualifications, what's their agenda, what do they want to try to accomplish once they're confirmed on these very important positions. So yeah, I do think that this is an issue that we'll probably be talking about more. I think that there will be some question of whether or not the governor's office and Senate leadership might try to wire around Senator Hicks' ability to hold up these nominees. But at the end of the day, I think all members of the Senate should be should take heed of Senator Hicks when she says that she took careful consideration. I very much believe that she did, and ultimately found them unqualified, in her words, to fulfill these roles and duties required for each of these positions. So this is, again, something we'll see. And whether the governor puts forward new nominees or whether there's a line drawn in the sand and we see a fight to get these two folks confirmed, it would be interesting to see why the governor would go to the mat on this, because if you look at in the instance of Gray, the Oklahoma reports that Gray has never taken oath of office or attended any of these board meetings since being nominated, and with no explanation provided for his absence. So even if you've been nominated, even before you've taken the oath, at the very least you could show up. And I think that a big part of public service is just showing up. And if you can't even take the time to show up after you've been nominated and have a presence there or explain why you can't be there, that does raise some big questions as to whether or not you should be nominated or whether you should be ultimately confirmed by the Senate for this position.
Neva.
It's interesting because executive nominations are usually pro forma. You have the senator, the individual that has been nominated or appointed to a position, goes through a process where they come to the Senate. Their senator in the district that they live puts that nomination forward, and there's a vote. Typically, they often occur in batches, multiple ones in a day, oftentimes in the middle or toward the end of session, where they hold them all together. There are a number of nominations and appointments that are still out there that need to be attended to during this session. And I think this does add to, again, the intrigue of, will this become a political football to be negotiated back and forth between the governor's office and the Senate to get things that one or the other are still jockeying to get done before the session is over. In this instance, you have two nominees of the governor, one on the State Board of Education, the other on the Oklahoma Department of Libraries Board of Directors. These are positions that need to be filled. In the instance, as you said, Ryan, where Alex Gray, he was actually nominated by the governor last fall, I believe in October. And there have been, in more than one case, published accounts of the fact that he has not yet attended a board meeting, hasn't taken his oath. And in the instance of the second person in question that is in Senator Hicks' district, she is currently serving, I believe, on the library department board, but her term expires this summer, so this would be a reappointment. So if that does not occur, then that vacancy again will have to go through a process of the governor submitting a nominee for the Senate to confirm or not. So it is a political football when you talk about the cabinet secretaries and others. A lot of these folks are somewhat in limbo, agency directors and others, waiting to have this formalized during session. And this kind of action by Senator Hicks raising the question of, as you say, Ryan, she has said she believes in her own betting she finds the individual she's been asked to carry their nominations to be unqualified for the duties that that those particular board positions require. So, again, I think this is one we just have to follow with interest to say that there's not always this give and take with this process. It would not be accurate, in my opinion, because you do have an instance where governors tend to have their appointees confirmed unless there is some overarching reason that comes to light where a number of people believe that they are that particular individual may not be qualified or may have something in their background that is unacceptable, but they normally don't get to the close to the finish line. They're normally kind of taken out of the equation up front and just don't wind up being a headline or a discussion point to put the senator in that person's district on the front line to have to make the case that it should not move forward. So, again, let's watch with interest and see what happens.
I thought it was interesting in the Oklahoman report about this that Senator Hicks' office didn't name the two individuals in her statement that said that that Senator Hicks found them unqualified and that Senator Hicks was not going to carry these nominations forward. And even whenever Senator Hicks' office was asked by the Oklahoman for their names, they refused to, Senator Hicks' office refused to give those names out, and they only got those names whenever the Oklahoman reached out to the governor's office. And so that is interesting. And I think that demonstrates, you know, some decorum from Senator Hicks' office about not wanting to throw individual people under the bus and making this more about policy. But it could also, I think, reflect, and this is speculative, right? But, you know, that's what podcasts are for. That Senator Hicks' reasons, you know, may be the kind of thing that Senator Hicks is careful to not want to have to associate with a particular individual. And so, you know, what those conversations look like in the background are very interesting. And there could be give and take. And we're at the point in the legislative session where the days are wearing thin. And the time prep for getting these things done is quickly coming to a close. And we'll be at the end of May before we know it. So there could be some give and take. And at this point in session, there are always instances where collateral items, you know, things that have nothing to do with this thing, could have an influence on the outcome of these two nominees.
You know, I think it's important to know that when we talk about these boards and commissions, there's dozens and dozens of them. They serve a purpose and do, in many instances, very important work. But these are private citizens that have been asked or nominated or come forward and offered themselves in their professions or in their interest areas to serve, and it's without pay. It is a public service, and so I think it's important for listeners to remember that oftentimes these folks are well intentioned, prepared, and willing to serve, and sometimes get caught in the political crossfire that has nothing to do with them or their background or making, but just part of the process that we're outlining with respect to executive nominations and that process they go through to be confirmed by the state Senate.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
The Cherokee Nation is pushing back after Governor Stitt posted the terms of a proposed 10-year compact over car tags. Tribal leaders say no agreement has been reached. Neva, what's going on here?
Well, it's this give and take exchange between, Chief Hoskin with the Cherokee Nation and the governor as this heated battle over the car tag compact continues. And in this instance, it's the give and take of who needed to do what first or where we are in the process to get something done. You know, as we've talked about, I think earlier in the session, the legislature actually had a bill, it died in committee, that would have allowed the Department of Public Safety to forward tribal tag information to the Turnpike Authority that would be able to be used for billing addresses so that people that went through tolls didn't have the sticker and had not been able to prepay that that they would be billed for those tolls. And that seems to be the sticking point. And this conversion that went to plate pay, where they have the process in place now, you can't just go sailing up and down the turnpike without paying, because you're going to get something in the mail that's going to be a bill that they expect to be taken care of. In this instance, I think we're still in this process going back and forth with both sides, basically somewhat intractable in their position, but it would seem like there is the ability that has been kind of in the middle of all of this for them to sort it out and actually get to a place where everyone is satisfied, the governor's office, the governor, and the tribe. But we're not there yet, and I think this is just a continuation as they see data and they start throwing out this information. When you start trying to make that case and fight that fight in social media, I'm not sure it's ever very productive, because folks are always getting just kind of the upshot and the details are where they need to be hammered out, and that's in a room with negotiators from all parties that can actually get that process accomplished and get the job done for everyone.
Ryan.
Negotiation by Twitter, I agree, negotiation by Twitter isn't going to get a compact signed here. We're not going to see a contract renewal because the governor puts something on Twitter and Principal Chief Hoskin of the Cherokee Nation gets on Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it and says, oh my gosh, look, here's this great offer from the governor, and then tweets back, we agree. That's not how this is going to work. And oftentimes you have, two levels of negotiation. One is the PR negotiation, where both sides, the Cherokee Nation and the governor, are going to be having a conversation with both tribal citizens and the people of Oklahoma and the media about what they really want to happen. And then hopefully, and we just don't really know the ins and outs of this because we're not in those rooms, but hopefully there are also negotiations that are happening behind closed doors. And those are the negotiations that might ultimately lead to the signing of a new compact between the Cherokee Nation and the state of Oklahoma. I think publicly what we see from the state of Oklahoma and on behalf of the state of Oklahoma by Governor Stitt is this blame game, where the governor is saying that millions and millions of dollars will be lost in turnpike revenue because the Cherokee Nation refuses to assent to the governor's new compact terms.
Right.
And in reality, what we are seeing is that it's not just Cherokee Nation issue. It's this new system that the state of Oklahoma adopted, this vendor that they selected, and they're having issue with all sorts of things, whether it's paper plates or some plates that are obfuscated by some sort of something on the car. There are other states that were having issues being able to read their out-of-state plates as well. So it's not just the Cherokee Nation, as the governor, I think, would hope folks would believe, so that he had a little bit more leverage in the negotiation process. The bill that you mentioned, Senate Bill 1907, it did fail in a Senate committee by a vote of 6-2. And we've talked about on this program before, normally if a bill is going to fail, especially if it's going to fail that bad, it normally doesn't even come up for a vote. And this almost didn't come up for a vote even after it was presented in committee, because as the Tulsa World reports, there wasn't even, for the longest time, there wasn't even a motion to pass the bill, which is required, and then a second to that motion that's required for there even to be a vote in committee. But once that happened, it failed on a 6-2 vote. The Tulsa World reports that the Oklahoma Intertribal Tax Association had been lobbying against the bill. And what they were saying was that the bill misconstrued the agreement between the tribes and the state of Oklahoma. They said the tribes had agreed to provide public safety information for law enforcement purposes over to the state of Oklahoma, so that tribes and the state of Oklahoma could cooperate on public safety and law enforcement issues. But the tribes did not agree to give that information to the state so that it could then be passed on to the department, to the Oklahoma Turnpike Authority, or the Department of Transportation, so that they could then be taxed without some sort of a conversation around the compacts and jurisdiction and all sorts of these other issues that are at play, hopefully, again, in these negotiations. Again, if the governor can't come to an agreement with the Cherokee Nation, I suspect that we'll see the state legislature either in session or in special session look again to use their power that was affirmed by the Oklahoma State Supreme Court to have some sort of extension of the license plate compact, so that there's at least some framework in place moving ahead before there's a final negotiation between the governor and the Cherokee Nation.
And when you talk about these compact agreements, let's remember that the Chickasaw and Choctaw Nations have already made compact agreements. They have a process now where they issue their tribal tags through Service Oklahoma tag agencies that are tribal tag agencies. But through that process, as all of the other tag agencies across the state, so there is a way to hammer through the details, it would appear, and come to agreements that are satisfactory. And ultimately, it has to be, again, satisfactory and a win-win, because we're talking about millions of dollars currently in question that have not been that the state has not been able to capture as a result of identifying the folks that have been going on the toll roads, on these turnpikes, and have not paid. And of course, that's not exclusive to folks that have tribal tags. It's folks going up and down these turnpikes, period, that now have to pay one way or the other. This process that was put in place by the state, it is in place, and now they just have to work through with these respective parties to see what will happen to deal with the issues. Continuing to say that everyone should have been kind of at the table up front, and they should have hammered out and identified some of these problems beforehand, is water under the bridge. Now it's important to just find a way to address this satisfactorily. And as you say, Ryan, at the point that it continues to not be addressed, it will draw lawmakers back into the equation, whether it's, in some fashion through some vehicle still alive in this legislative session or the next session, it will still be something that will have to be addressed.
Orion and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of KOSU, its staff, or management. The programs like this are made possible through support from KOSU members who are listeners like you. Consider a gift to KOSU in support of This Week in Oklahoma Politics at donate.kosu.org.
Hey there, this is Jenny Mae Harms with KOSU, where we want to talk with you, not just at you. One way we connect with listeners just like you is through social media, like Instagram. So follow us at KOSU Radio, where you'll get a behind-the-scenes look into KOSU reporting, station news, and even ticket giveaways. Just follow KOSU Radio on Instagram, and we'll see you there.
Step into the world of limitless imagination with Beyond the Art podcast, where Indigenous creativity knows no bounds. Join me, Corey Beaumont Flynn, host of Beyond the Art, on a captivating journey through art and innovation, where we delve into the depths of imagination, daring to push the boundaries of what's possible. Our guests, hailing from the Native American art world, represent diverse artistic sectors, from musicians to photographers, beadwork artists to filmmakers, each sharing their unique creative vision and inspiring journeys. Search for Beyond the Art and start listening today.